I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have two cases to be heard on our 1:30 docket, and all the parties on both cases have signed in. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Sutterth. Will the clerk call the case? Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. This case this afternoon is about concrete. Concrete is an ubiquitous building material, not unlike lumber or nails, that's used in many construction projects for many reasons. The Supreme Court of Texas in 2016 decided a case called Centerpoint that stands for the proposition that that Chapter 82 does not create a right to assert a Chapter 82 indemnity claim to every building contractor who purchases generic building materials for use on a construction project. And I'll talk about that case in more depth in just a second. As for the lawsuit, it started off as a lawsuit by the Dankles, who had hired Miller to build a driveway and a concrete pad for them. They sued for breach of contract and DTPA. The case was tried to a jury, and the jury found in favor of the Dankles, and a judgment was entered against Miller Construction Company based on those jury answers to questions. That part of the case is not on appeal and is not why we're here today. In addition to the Dankles claim, there's a third-party claim asserted by Miller Construction against a company that I'm just going to call RDJ, who sold the concrete that Miller Construction used as part of the construction process.
Counsel, if I'm remembering the record right, didn't your client concede at some point during all this that at least some part of the concrete that was sent off to the site was defective?
They conceded that there was a problem with the concrete that would need to be repaired or replaced, a portion of the concrete on the pad, not on the driveway. That was the testimony. As I'll talk about in just a second, though, the language of Chapter 82 that requires a product liability action to be alleged and proved, and the elements of that product liability action set out in Chapter 82 is the basis for the appeal by RDJ.
So are you taking the position that it was the Dankles who had to have cast this in terms of a products liability action in order for the third-party complaint to have been proper?
No, the third-party plaintiff could have asserted a contribution or indemnity claim, as they did under Chapter 82. But a part of that claim or a part of that cause of action requires that the underlying pleading against Miller Construction Company be a product liability action in terms of the facts, whether it's ultimately cast as a breach of contract or a DTPA claim. Another thing to keep in mind, because this is all relatively new, is that in the Freshcoat case,
is this something that you're advocating for the first time? Because I've read the cases that have been cited, and I don't recall any argument like that in any of those cases?
Well, our argument is that there's no evidence or insufficient evidence of three elements required by Chapter 82.
But the pleading requirement is what I'm talking about. That idea that you've got to plead the third-party plaintiff has to plead the product's liability.
In all of the post-trial motions, of which there were three, we said there was no evidence or insufficient evidence of a product liability action, and included in the language of Chapter 82 that describes a Chapter 82 action, there's a requirement that that underlying pleading be a product liability claim, even if it involves perhaps non-tort claims.
Do you feel like your special exceptions were specific enough to bring that particular complaint to the court's attention?
I'm not complaining about that at all. All I'm saying is that the requirement that there be a product liability action is part of the burden of proof that Miller Construction had in asserting their Chapter 82 claim, and that there was no product liability action alleged against it that triggers application of Chapter 82. That's our first no evidence, insufficient evidence point, is there's no evidence or insufficient evidence that there was a product liability action being asserted against Miller that would trigger any Chapter 82 indemnity claim. And that as a result of that, the case should be reversed and rendered. And so I'm only talking about the pleadings of the Dankos just to make the point that under the Chapter 82 requirement and the fresh coat comment that perhaps it doesn't even apply to non-tort claims, at the very least, the Dankos did not plead the required product liability action that would trigger Miller's ability to assert a Chapter 82 claim.
So you believe that the original plaintiff in a case like this, that they have to put something, I mean, do they have to use the words defective product liability claim? I mean, what exactly are you saying that the Dankos did not do?
They did not assert the elements of a product's liability claim, whether it's design, manufacturing, or marketing. None of those. They had a single paragraph made up of one or two sentences that said there was a breach of the agreement they had with Miller Construction Company, and the breach was that a defective concrete was used to build their driveway.
And you don't think that the phrase defective concrete signaled, I mean, we've got notice pleading. You don't think that's clear enough to suggest that they were talking about a defective product?
Not all of the elements of a product liability claim. A defective product, defective at the time it left the possession of the manufacturer, that created unreasonably dangerous risk to the user and was a producing cause of property damage. I don't think a isolated reference to defect begins to state a product liability action under Chapter 82. And in addition to the, let me go back to where I was about to start, and that is on our no evidence points. There are three no evidence points. One, that under Fresh Coat and later Center Point, Miller Construction's not a seller. And that argument has nothing to do with the manner in which the case was pled. And that argument that he was not a seller or is not a seller is based on Centerpoint, which was decided in 2016, which again attempted to describe or change or modify or explain in greater detail who is entitled to assert a Chapter 82 claim. In Fresh Coat, they extended the definition of seller to someone who both sells, in the case of Fresh Coat, they sold and installed EFAS systems. That's what Fresh Coat did. And the Supreme Court, in considering whether or not a person who sells and also installs could be a covered seller under Chapter 82, they concluded that they could.
Well, okay. I'm trying to think of a hypothetical homeowner who wants a concrete pad poured. I mean,
yes.
Nobody would go to your client directly as a homeowner and say, come pour me a concrete pad. They would get that through a contractor, correct?
Ordinarily, but they certainly could go order it directly.
Okay.
So when a homeowner wants someone to pour, let's just say a patio, just
sure,
a slab, for no other purpose, then is that worker who, or that business that pours the concrete patio, not also selling the concrete as well?
Well, in our case, RDJ sells liquid concrete from a concrete truck. They would not pour that patio, as you just described. And so they're a seller. Miller is an entity, and it can be an individual, the homeowner, it could be a contractor they hire, it could be anyone who's knowledgeable. That person is the person who ordinarily would install our product on that homeowner's property.
So RDJ is never going to face any possible liability under Chapter 82 because the fact that it brings liquid concrete out to a site, you know, that the fact that it comes there, no matter how defective it is, I mean, that's the end of the chain. Nobody who pours it after that's a seller.
Well, those are liability questions. There could be a hundred different answers to that. RDJ, is, as a seller of concrete, has a potential liability to someone who experiences a loss, like the Dankles. But the Dankles didn't sue RDJ. The Dankles sued Miller. And Miller doesn't have a claim of damages because he didn't sustain any damages. What he has, or thinks he has, is an indemnity claim that's a creature of statute only. And that statute is very detailed in the burden of proof that Miller has got to establish, three separate elements of which they establish none, in order to be able to assert that claim. And that's why we're here. And with regard to Freshcoat, Freshcoat's situation is very different from Miller Construction. Freshcoat was in the business, according to the Supreme Court, in the business of selling EFAS systems and installing them. Freshcoat employees were trained and certified by the EFAS manufacturer, K2. So there was no question when the court dealt with the question about can you be a seller and installer, that they were dealing with a company very different than Miller. And then 6 years later comes CenterPoint. And CenterPoint addresses the question, is every general contractor out in the marketplace potentially a claimant under Chapter 82?
And the answer they gave was it depends on the facts.
That's
and they
correct.
Were concerned that they didn't use nails as an example, but what it appears the Supreme Court was concerned about is that if there's a product liability issue with regard to nails or wooden planks or trusses or whatever you're talking about, that
right.
every component part of a house, from the pipes to the wires to the nails to the sheetrock, whatever is on the house, would potentially put the general contractor in the position of selling those products. And what the Supreme Court said was that's while the quantity is not, I think the Supreme Court said the quantity doesn't determine the outcome, it's certainly a factor to be considered. In this case, we've just got somebody pouring concrete.
Well, not according to the testimony in the trial. Mr. Miller testified in great detail about having spent several days out at the Dankles home preparing the land, the dirt, the forms that would hold this poured concrete. Poured concrete, if you pour it on the floor, just spreads out and is nothing. So it has to have form. So he spent several days with his crew doing all the dirt work and prep work before there could ever be any concrete delivered.
Okay, so dirt isn't going to be subject to products liability. So what we're talking about are wooden forms.
Rebars.
The rebar and the nails that perhaps...
The saw cuts that are done after the concrete's been put in place. The saw cut's done by Miller, not done by RDJ.
But a saw cut is not a product. It's a service.
Well, but it could be a negligent claim that the family could have. All I'm saying is that when you look at the record, especially Miller's testimony, because it was so detailed, he describes the same sort of activities that I could describe as a person who's using lumber. Lumber can be used for all sorts of things. Concrete can be used for all sorts of things, but both of those things involve lots of other things going on along with it before that product ends up being a building or a shed or whatever it ends up being.
Isn't that why the Supreme Court has told us it depends on the facts?
Well, they said that, but what they also said, in addition to depending on the facts, is that the sale, if it's incidental to the contract, that to them was the key. If it's incidental to the contract, then there shouldn't be any Chapter 82 claim available. And that is clearly the case here. If you look at the invoice, which is the contract in this case, there is no reference to sale or selling the concrete. There's no reference in Miller's contract with Dankle that he was creating an upcharge for that concrete. There is nothing in that contract that mentions the word concrete at all. So the essence of the contract was that Miller Construction was going to build a concrete driveway and a concrete pad for the Dankles. That was the essence of the contract. And the fact that Mr. Miller had to go out and get concrete as part of the construction materials necessary to build the structure is incidental. And at least the Supreme Court in writing Centerpoint said that was the focus of the analysis. And you need only compare Freshcoat's role vis-a-vis the K2 EFAS system to Miller Construction's role with the Dankles in building their driveway and their pad to see that he far more closely aligns with Centerpoint, the general contractor, than he does with Freshcoat. And as a result of that, I think that that even though there's a fact issue, there are still three elements that they've got to prove that we believe there was no evidence offered on. There was no evidence of seller. And, of course, the court will look at Freshcoat and Centerpoint. But number two, there was no product liability action alleged in the underlying case. That's a requirement. And third, there was no property damage. The only damages being sought by the Dankles and that they recovered were economic damages, the loss of the benefit of the bargain. And under the economic loss rule, those damages are not recoverable in tort. So they claimed and they proved and they got a judgment for economic damages, not for tort property damage. And for any one of those three reasons, or any combination of those three reasons, Miller was not able to avail himself of Chapter 82, in our opinion.
I believe you're out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court. It's often interesting to see how parties differ, where I think we're absolutely aligned with Freshcoat. I presented you with an exhibit that's before you that outlines why I think that Mr. Miller is very aligned with Freshcoat. Freshcoat was an installer of EFAS products. Miller was an installer of concrete. Both of them require preparation of the site to be installed. There was testimony with regard to Mr. Miller that he installed the concrete according to standards. The same is true in the Freshcoat case. When Miller was sued, he sought indemnification from the manufacturer. That's the same thing that happened in Freshcoat. Now, Centerpoint is a different case. Centerpoint was a summary judgment case. And Centerpoint, in fact, was certified to go up as an early appeal. The Supreme Court said, though, in Centerpoint, well, some contractors may engage in the business of selling both products and services. The record is devoid of evidence that Centerpoint was doing so here. In fact, what happened in Centerpoint is a sheetrocker was walking across a truss that was uninstalled. The sheetrocker fell. He became a paraplegic. He sued the gamut of folks. Centerpoint sought indemnification from Trussway for this uninstalled truss. That would be akin to a 2x4 laying in the aisle of Home Depot and somebody suing, Home Depot suing the provider of that 2x4 for indemnification. They weren't the end user. They didn't have a products liability claim. They had a misplaced product claim, if there is such a thing, which we don't think there is.
Well, let me ask you about the damages aspect of this case. You know, as you heard the appellant say, and as you know, they're taking the position that the Dankles were just talking about pure contract, economic loss, that sort of thing, as opposed to property damage, which the statute seems to restrict the Chapter 82 action to damages arising out of personal injury, death, or property damage caused by the defective product. What do you view as the property damage that falls within the statute?
Well, there was testimony with regard to the consequential damages that related to the concrete having to be removed and replaced. That would be property damage.
So you're taking a more expansive view of that term than...
Well, clearly there was no personal injury to a person. But I believe that property damage is you affect the ability of somebody to use their property when you pour concrete on there that is then defective, and there's an inability to place a load on that concrete, and therefore it must be pulled out. That is property damage. That's a loss of use. In addition, I believe that the statute and is recited in the question 8, there is an instruction that says Miller can, that unless you find the loss to Guy and Janet Dankel was caused by Bobby Miller's negligence, intentional misconduct, or other act or omission, such as negligently modifying or altering the product, that you're required to indemnify Bobby Miller. His loss, Bobby Miller's loss, was this lawsuit. Miller's only business is the business of installing installed concrete. And Miller prices his concrete, I believe the testimony shows, at a cost per square foot. The fact that he's has a line item that says concrete and doesn't have a profit amount to it, I believe is a non-starter that the council seems to raise. The fact that council is now claiming that there was no notice that the product that was installed at the Dankel's house was defective. Justices, you merely need to look at the pleading with the circle marks here, which is plaintiff's original petition, where on this page 3 I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 statements of defective concrete. Additionally, my associate or counsel here for the Dankels will tell you in more detail that counsel for the Gateway RDJ, in fact, in their answer, talked about product liability in multiple ways.
That was my question. How was it tried? Whether it was pled artfully or not, how was the case cast? How was it tried?
The case was cast as a product liability case. We have defective concrete here. There was a statement from the third-party defendant to the effect, yes, we had a problem with our concrete. We had too much fly ash, at least in the first batch. That caused a defect in the product. Additionally, there was a motion for summary judgment by the third-party defendant where they admitted they had a defective product. There was no question about whether it was defective. Justice Souterth, if I can find in my paperwork here, there are a couple. Thoughts. Mr. Miller, on page 247 of volume 3, starts out, question, okay, now you didn't do anything with regard to the content of this concrete, right? Answer, say that again. Question, you didn't mix this concrete, right? Answer, no. All you did was order it, yes. Followed by testimony again in volume 3, page 168 of Robert Nance, an expert hired by the Dankels. On direct exam, how do we get the concrete out of the truck? Answer, typically, a concrete operator will add more water to the mix, mix it back up, and get the concrete to flow down the chute. Question, and who is the concrete operator? The truck driver? Answer, the concrete driver. Question, all right, so he has control of the product through the manufacturing process because he backs his truck up under the chute for the mixture, correct? Answer, yes, sir. Question, and he continues to have control of that product until it comes off the tail end of his chute, correct? Answer, yes, sir. Then there was ample discussion at trial, pictures introduced with regard to the coloration of the concrete, the inability for it to become hard, and that it was in fact defective. Does that answer your question, Justice? All right, I'll defer my time.
Thank you.
Counsel? Justice? I'll be brief. Essentially, Justice Kerr, you asked about special exceptions. Those were never ruled on. And the only special exceptions filed in this case were against essentially the defendant's pleadings, the third-party petition. Counsel for Mr. Miller brought up the fact that there was a summary judgment filed. It was never set or heard. I'm having a little bit of difficulty with this entire matter, primarily because you, I'm presuming, saw my brief, and it looks to me like they waived every bit of any of this in the trial court. And the reason is because, just like the special exceptions, they never had those ruled on. Just like the summary judgment, they never presented that to the court. When we get back into the post-trial motions, all of this seller information that we're talking about, that's the first time that's ever been heard by the court. They get up and they argue that it's not a product liability case, and that's fine. They can do that. The problem is to answer you, Justice Southworth, it was tried completely as a product liability case. There was no issue at trial other than defective concrete. That was it. That's what it was tried on. And if you want to know really how that worked, they never really disputed that it was defective concrete at all. They disputed how much. They didn't like the cracks. There was testimony about extensive cracking, extensive discoloration, chipping, and whether when a saw cut comes through, how there's raveling that happens. All of that aside, you know, essentially the appellant wants you to believe that this was never a product liability case when, in fact, I'm not sure exactly how you would phrase it other than to use the word defective over and over.
Well, if this was so clearly from start to finish a products liability case, did the trial court's exclusion of the expert witness really undercut their ability to defend against that
claim? I don't think so, and the reason because they actively disputed, with even on cross with our expert, whether or not it was defective concrete. So they were capable of crossing that. Their expert, that situation was, again, I'm going to say they waived all that because they did the offer of proof after the jury was in the jury room.
Was that not driven by the trial court's instructions or scheduling of making that offer of proof?
It may be. Thinking back as we were sitting through that, the problem with that is the manner in which it occurred. I think it's incumbent upon the appellant to preserve that error, not on us to make sure that they preserve their error. In other words, you know, too little, too late kind of problem. Whether the trial court controls that completely, it's incumbent upon them to submit that prior to the jury going out of the box. Otherwise, I mean, the whole purpose of an offer of proof is so the court has an opportunity to know what that evidence is, and if it does need to be presented to the jury, let them do it. Once the jury's out, it's over. The property damage issue with regards to this, once that concrete's affixed to the realty, it is property. It's real property. And I've got a bunch of defective real property at that point. To answer Justice Sutter, the person pouring patio is always going to be a seller. I don't know how you can get around it. I think it is important to understand the difference between center point with absolutely no evidence that they're selling in conjunction and fresh coat K2, where exactly that's what they did. And that's all Bobby Miller did. At this point, I'm not sure that there's been any preservation of error on any of these issues, including if you look at their request to be submitted to the jury. There's absolutely no information in their proposed jury charge, any question at all about seller. That's not in anything. But we're hearing about it now in this appeal. So the other problem is when we get into the whole why did Dankel sue Miller, we have no privity with Gateway RDJ. My clients couldn't sue Gateway RDJ. We had to sue Miller because that's who actually we interacted with. And it was incumbent upon Miller to do that. And Miller actually put in Chapter 82, Their answer prior to trial responded with regards to Chapter 82. So I'm not sure exactly how they thought that we were going to try this. They knew full well that it was a Chapter 82 problem for them. But all of a sudden now what we're ending up with is a situation that says, oh, it's not a product liability case. I'm not sure exactly this whole incidental to the contract. I'm not sure exactly how you can have, I want a pad and a driveway, but no concrete. How could it be incidental? I mean, it was the core of what my clients wanted. So, thank you.
Justice Kerr, in answer to your question, this case was pled, tried, and submitted as a breach of contract and DTPA case, the DTPA claim being misrepresentations with regard to the contract itself and the negotiations related thereto. The plaintiffs called a witness who was a concrete tester. They did not call an expert witness who would testify based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that there was a defect in the concrete when it left the manufacturer, that it created an unreasonable risk of harm, that it caused property damage. The guy who testified, Mr. Nance, admitted that he did not have an opinion and wasn't giving an opinion that there was any structural defect in the driveway or the pad. He likewise did not offer any opinions regarding whether or not the concrete was defective in terms of the product liability requirements, and that is defective at the time it left the manufacturer, that it was unreasonably dangerous for its intended use, here a driveway and a pad for a shed, or that there was property damage. So the case was tried, submitted, and a judgment entered based on breach of contract and DTPA claims. And as a result of that, there was not a product liability action, which is an essential element of Chapter 82.
Do you feel like error was preserved on the question of whether Miller was a seller for purposes of Chapter 82?
Absolutely, because seller is just one of the three elements of a product liability action. And in all three of those post-trial motions, we specifically alleged that there was no evidence of a product liability action. And when you say that, you're talking about all parts of Chapter 82. And the three essential elements of Chapter 82 that we don't think Miller complied with, one of them is seller. So the word seller was not used in those post-trial motions, but it's subsumed within our objection, our no-evidence objection based
on. So is it your position that the jury did not need to determine as a factual matter whether Miller was a seller?
That's a good question. I do not think the Dankles had to submit the status of Miller as a seller for them to get the recovery that they were seeking.
Well, no, wouldn't your client want the jury to say that Miller wasn't a seller?
Only if there was evidence that he was. And our contention is that there was no evidence or insufficient evidence that in this transaction and based on CenterPoint's analysis that Miller could be construed as a seller under any circumstance based on our record.
Do you agree as to the third point that you failed to preserve error in the offer of proof?
No. I think that a trial lawyer... Keep in mind, this expert witness business came up during the trial on the third day of trial, and the objection only had to do with public records and things that you could access on a website. So it's not like the guy shows up with new opinions or a new report. And so under the abuse of discretion rules regarding excluding experts, I think that the court, in fact, abused its discretion. But back to your question with regard to a waiver, they started the guy's testimony, the bill, before lunch. And then when they got back from lunch, the judge said, we're going to do it after the jury retires. And he took responsibility for that. I don't remember the exact line from the record, but there's a statement by him that it was on him that this testimony was, that the completion of the bill was done after the fact. And another thing to keep in mind is that the basis for him excluding the witness really wasn't dependent on the bill. The court excluded the witness because he was tired of discussing these five or six documents. One was a book and others you had to go on a website to access. He was tired about the delay between Wednesday night And him trying to wrap up his trial on Thursday and Friday of our expert who's up in Denton, Texas, in an office in Dallas, not being able to get these four or five documents, which at the end of the day, under Supreme Court cases and even under a case that this court decided, is not enough to exclude a witness.
But it was more than just those five items.
Those triggered.
Didn't he have a personal file or whatever it was referred to?
He did, but there was no showing that it contained anything other than some photographs and duplications of things that they were provided. So, and again, the record is murky, to say the least, about all that. But what happened is that the plaintiffs lay behind the log. They raised this issue about missing documents that they had the responses for a year. In the third day of trial, before a busy trial judge trying to get his trial finished. And we didn't respond as quickly as the judge wanted, and we got our witness excluded. Thank you.
Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Your case has now been submitted, and you are free to leave if you would like. We have another argument coming up. If you want to stay and listen to that, you're welcome to stay as well. But we thank